Hello and welcome to our second broadcast of How Positive Are You? News and views from the other side of AIDS with independent researcher David Crow and yours truly, Christine Maggiore, author of What If Everything You Thought You Knew About AIDS Was Wrong.
Hi, Christine. It's great to be doing our second episode of this podcast.
I'm excited. I'm really into this.
And the theme music, you can explain where that came from.
Yes, the theme music for this show was composed by my 10-year-old son, Charlie, who is into messing around with the computer program GarageBand, in addition to playing cello and piano and recently making tryouts for an ice hockey team.
Yes. Well, that's great. Next time I need my VCR fixed, I'll have him come over and show me how to set the time on it. Except they don't have VCRs anymore, do they? I guess it'll have to be my DVD player.
Right, man of a thousand talents, Charlie Scovel.
Yes, yeah, he certainly knows technology, and he's got a real musical ear, too. So that's great to have his contribution to the show. And we've had some pretty good feedback from other people as well. Gregory said, "Great podcast with Christine. I enjoyed it all the way through." Kim said, "I loved it. I think you guys really have a good rapport." Sasha said, "This will blow me away, cool vibesters. I love it. Go for it, you guys." And then she gave a bunch of useful suggestions about how to make it a bit better in the future and some topics to address. Brad said, "I loved how you talk to each other and sort of inform each other, which the other will then augment and either add to or fill in the blanks about. You seem to challenge each other in a spirited, friendly way, which keeps the show at a really excellent pace and highly informative and energetic. It's so great you're doing this. I think audio and video are a good supplement to print in this day and age and can often sink in more effectively." Phil called it fascinating work and gave us some useful suggestions, including not eating grapefruit, and I think that was directed at you. And for me, he said, "Be a bit more careful with sarcasm. It's not always so easy for people listening to the show to get the fact that you're being sarcastic."
So true.
I'll have to tone that down a little bit or be a little bit more... a little bit more obvious. Hey, I'm going to be sarcastic now.
Yeah, that'll work.
Yes. Okay, so in a few minutes, we're going to go to a radio show with Katie Awadu of Lib Radio, which I believe stands for Living in Black Radio. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Katie?
Well, I've known Katie for many years. He's someone who's very concerned about the issues and information surrounding HIV and AIDS, especially as it affects African Americans and Africans anywhere. As we discussed during that program with him, and maybe we touched upon this in our first podcast, there's a racial bias in HIV testing. Something about the test reacts with something about people of color that has nothing to do with actual risks, behavioral risks, or what we call AIDS risks or exposure to HIV. And people who are black test positive disproportionate to people of other races. And this is just one issue of many that are of concern to people like Katie, who are really paying attention to the information rather than just accepting the idea that black people, for some reason having to do mostly with this notion of rampant sexual promiscuity or men having sex with men on the, quote, down low and notions like this that can't be really substantiated with science or epidemiology or social studies, that there are other things going on that causes disproportionate positivity among black people. And he's one who is questioning this and urging the churches and the barbershops and the other, you know, community organizations around the country to think about these things before accepting government handouts to perpetuate the notion that black people are different from white people with regard to HIV and AIDS.
Yeah, this is something that Dr. Henry Bauer has talked about a lot, the perhaps genetically black people are more likely to test false positive on these flawed tests. I mean, there's lots of signs, lots of science that shows that it's not promiscuity. For example, one study I mentioned when we were talking to Katie is from South Africa. About three times as many young black women are HIV positive as young black men, and yet women are, on average, less promiscuous. It just doesn't make sense. And why aren't prostitutes an AIDS risk group unless they're IV drug users? You know, there's just a lot of things that tell us it's not really sexual. I think a better model is things like blood types. You know, everybody knows about type A and B and AB and O. And those are quite heavily linked to race. But we don't really assign much meaning to them. You know, people who have type A or B blood are not any healthier or less healthy than the others. And yet there are significant racial genetic differences in blood types that are important when you're trying to determine if blood is compatible, but aren't important for telling if somebody's going to get sick and die in the next few months or years.
Right, and it's amazing to me, with all the scientific minds focused on this question of HIV and AIDS, that there's very little regard for the specific science that you're talking about, of looking at how blood types react differently to these non-specific so-called HIV tests. This is a matter of science and physiology. This is not a matter of behavior, and I certainly think there's some racist undertones in the assumption that black people, whether they're on the continent of Africa or whether they're on North American soil, are somehow behaving in ways that are irresponsible and dangerous, whereas their white counterparts are not behaving in such ways, and that explains the disparity in the positive test results that occurs between white people and black people. I just think there's something that needs to be explored on a scientific and physiological level rather than being driven by these odd social assumptions.
Can I turn on the sarcasm meter here and just note that in North America, in the white-dominated media, they never talk about sex. And, you know, on sitcoms and things like that, there's never sexual and innuendo or people dressed in a sexually provocative way, right? Am I correct that it's always very puritanical on television in North America?
Was that sarcastic?
That was sarcastic.
So the answer I give is a sarcastic, why no, David?
Yes, it's always Little House on the Prairie. That's the only thing that's on these days.
Yeah.
Desperate Housewives was canceled because everybody wants to watch Little House on the Prairie.
Uh-huh. Okay, let me know when you're done being sarcastic.
Okay, I think I'm done now. I think we should probably go to the discussion with Katie now.
That sounds great.
You've been listening to the music of Julie Dexter. Her CD is entitled Conscious, and that was the title track. Wonderful music from a beautiful person. We are live and direct today. Today's date is Thursday, the 19th of June. We are in our second hour of a three-hour broadcast today when we're talking about the end of heterosexual AIDS. Again, just a brief to give you a grounding for those just tuning in. An article appeared in a number of newspapers. We had read it from the Independent Online, which is a London-based newspaper. The article entitled, "Threat of World AIDS Pandemic Among Heterosexuals is Over," report admits. A 25-year health campaign was misplaced outside the continent of Africa, but the disease still kills more than all wars and conflicts, by Jeremy Lawrence. That from Sunday, June 8th, 2008. And, of course, some of us cringed on the byline title. We're going to go into that about the number of deaths from this pandemic, this disease. Welcoming back, joining us from the first hour, we have joining us from Rethinking AIDS, we have David Crowe. Welcome back to the conversation.
Hi, Katie. Thanks.
All right. And joining us on the telephone line, we have two very, very esteemed guests. Let's begin with a beauty before we before we introduce prowess. We have our beloved brother, our brother Jehudi Ma'atra Hotep African, you beautiful black man, you.
Hotep, thank you for your words, brother. Thank you for having me on.
Can you, before we go on to introduce the prowess, can you just give us a few sentences about yourself?
Tuti Ma'atra, being a herbalist, metaphysician, a couple other things, life guy coach, motivational, inspirational speaker. I kind of like to limit to those things there because that seems what the world needs more of, healing and inspiration. And I am the founder of dherbs.com, and I specialize in natural remedies for all health challenges and also write inspirational, motivational articles for people at large to help inspire them as they attempt to learn about life and the truth of existence in the matrix here.
All right. Well, beauty has been introduced. Now let's go to prowess, one of the most powerful voices out here. And one of the most feared individuals from the AIDS establishment joining us once again, longtime friend of mine, and we've been on so many great battle lines together. Let us welcome the wonderful, powerful, esteemed Christine Maggiore. Welcome to the conversation, Christine.
Thanks, Kitty. You're scaring me with that introduction, though.
Yeah, you scare everybody else, so it's coming back. Chicken's coming home to roost.
All right.
Christine, can you give us a few sentences about yourself, your background for today's conversation?
Sure. I'm a former business executive who in 1992 tested HIV positive, as it's called, during a routine medical exam, became a public speaker and educator for several AIDS organizations, and then at the urging of a doctor I saw, tested indeterminate positive, negative, and positive, developed a number of questions that weren't answered by the education I received or was giving other people or any of the experts at the AIDS organizations where I worked. So I set off to explore what had happened to me and what this meant in the context of the whole HIV equals AIDS paradigm, and ended up writing a book called What If Everything You Thought You Knew About AIDS Was Wrong. It's been 16 years since I tested positive. I've never taken any AIDS medications, and I live a super powerful life.
That's right. You certainly do. We have some more emails that are coming in. We're going to get right to those. But let's bring Jehudi and Christine into the conversation. I trust that both of you had a chance to read in detail either the news accounts of the WHO report, or I've actually been searching for the WHO report in its entirety. Let's begin with you, Christine. The end of the heterosexual AIDS threat around the world, except for Africans.
Yeah, that's something that really bothers me. And I think it should be bothering more people that we are ascribing wildly promiscuous sexual behavior to one group of people in this world, black people, who for some reason have some strange capacity to spread a disease or so-called disease that no one else manages to spread through the same sort of activity on less super levels. It's just ridiculous to me that we can make these sorts of statements in the year 2008 about black people. I thought we were long past this as a culture. And also, too, what's disturbing is the articles that suggest that not only is it wildly promiscuous behavior among black people that spreads this so-called disease, but the fact that many males in Africa are uncircumcised. The fact is that most males throughout most countries in the world are not circumcised. So why is anatomically correct male parts a problem only in Africa? Why not in Europe, in South America, in Central America, in Mexico? It's just ridiculous. And yet it's being taken in and adopted into popular culture and public health policy as if these racist notions were true. And I find that very discouraging.
Brother Jehudi, your response as a person of African ascent yourself, your response to the idea the rest of the heterosexuals around the world can just relax, unless they're using intravenous drugs. They can just relax, but that African people, they specifically mentioned sub-Saharan, but as you know, it's still being promoted amongst Africans in this country. But African people need to pull back and stop putting the penis in the vagina.
Well, you know, when you're dealing, you know, with this world, this imbalanced world here, the world of man, that is, let me clarify, and you have a particular group, Europeans, who deem or perceive themselves as superior or strong, then in order to justify that false and pseudo position, you will always have to subscribe to the notion that there is a weaker or inferior group of people, which in their eyes just happen to be African people. And so therefore, you know, the strong will always pick on the weak after all. They don't have the resources. They don't have the power. They can't organize. There's just a lot of things that they can't do. So why not always put things on them? You know, why not always have a scapegoat, you know? So I look at it as that, you know, and it's like that. It just happens to be in the area of AIDS, but you can pick a whole bunch of other things, and you'll always see that the Africans are always going to come up short, you know, on this little sick imbalance scale of certain people who are in positions of power. But, I mean, you know, if anyone knows me, my work, I mean, I've never subscribed to it. It's great, you know, that, you know, someone else can come along and print that this whole thing was a myth. You know, I did a show yesterday on word control, mind control. You know, the more we wake up and understand that this planet, especially the United States, is a word-controlled, okay, place, you know, then people can realize that if they master the words, look into the words, they can free themselves, you know. I mean, AIDS, you know. I mean, I think, Keita, we need to start with really breaking down AIDS. Most people don't know what AIDS is, you know. So a lot of false images and definitions of AIDS have come up, and people respond to them, you know. And especially, you know, African people, especially here in the United States, you know, where, you know, a lot of the people just in general are ignorant, you know, who don't read, you know. I think the reading comprehension is on a second grade level, you know. So people just hear things and react, you know, and the media capitalizes off of that, and people respond. And so they'll go get free testing, and they'll take so-called drugs, AZT and all this other crazy stuff that shoots out the immune system and which really does them in, you know. It's about education, beloved. What does myth mean? What is a myth? You know what I'm saying? It's a myth. Mm-hmm. It's not real. You know, so when people embrace in their mind that it's not real, then they can actually begin to heal on all levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So very true. Well, there have been numerous reports for many years that it wasn't real from major and minor news sources. There's been this huge dissenting community. One of the questions we asked in the first hour, and I'll just take a little different approach to the same question, is from those of us who have been voices of dissent, just how important is this admission from the World Health Organization, and how can we use this to better do what we have committed ourselves to doing? Christine?
I think it's important that this message be heard. I've noticed, at least as of last night, that this story has not been picked up by major media in the U.S., that this announcement about the world being free from the heterosexual AIDS pandemic, essentially that the heterosexual AIDS pandemic has been canceled, hasn't appeared in major media in the U.S., in print, on the radio, on television, anywhere. And it's interesting to me that this great news, so to speak, is, I don't know if there's an official embargo, if people don't know what to do, but one story that I read about this announcement in the UK Guardian mentioned that there has been reluctance on the part of UNAIDS and the World Health Organization to admit that their predictions of global AIDS were wrong because it would give more credence to so-called AIDS dissenters. So I don't know if that's being practiced here. You can't say what's true because it gives more power to the people who've been questioning the truth about all of this stuff. Or I just don't know why it's not being reported.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of a reasonable excuse, and I just can't imagine what that might be. But the important thing is that the facts be known. And we've had large official organizations receiving millions and billions of taxpayer dollars who haven't been telling us the truth, who have been knowingly not telling us the truth to protect their flow of funding and to protect their image of being right when, in fact, they were wrong.
That's so true. David, what do you expect you'll be able to do with this information?
Well, I think it's an amazing admission of just one of the things that dissidents have been saying for, I guess, 15, probably 20 years. We have been saying that the evidence for a heterosexual epidemic of AIDS is just not there. Even some fairly mainstream scientists, a group led by a man named David Gisselquist, were heavily censored and prejudiced against by the AIDS establishment, even though the only thing they were saying is that HIV in Africa was not a heterosexual epidemic. And, UNAIDS went as far as to send out a press release decrying this information, even though it's pretty simple. I mean, it boils down to a significant number of virgins who are HIV positive, a significant number of people who have only ever had one sexual partner, a greater number of women than men who are HIV positive in Africa, and a better correlation between things like the number of injections and HIV seropositivity rather than levels of promiscuity. So all of these things say that this is not behaving like a heterosexual epidemic, but they could not afford to drop this theory because it was so fundamental to the whole AIDS theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so very true. We are live and direct. It is Thursday, the 19th of June. We're going to open up the phone lines. Keep them open during the show in case anyone has a comment or a question. You can call us at 323-902-2919. You can call us toll-free at 800-842-1409. If you're in the UK, call us in London at 0208-002-9096. You can email us at info@libradio.net. You can Skype us at LIV Radio, as well as if you're viewing this on Ustream.tv, that's the letter Ustream.tv, we do have the chat board open there, and you could ask us a question through the chat board. Continuing, as we continue our dialogues, looks like we have a caller that is coming through, so let us go right to the telephone. Caller, welcome to the program. Your name and where you're calling from.
Greetings, Katie. And greetings to the panel. This is Ayadotta.
Ayadotta, calling from South Florida. Greetings. Welcome to the conversation. We're talking about the end of heterosexual AIDS. Unless you're African, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm an African and female, so I got two strikes.
Yeah. I know that you are not an injection drug user.
No, I'm not. Okay. But I wanted to find out, this is my first time hearing about the report when I tune in this morning, but I wanted to know if you can send me a link, only because I have a sister in a relationship with this brother who have an A taste like every 3 months. Don't ask me why.
Okay, he is so paranoid about his past life that he takes the HIV antibody test every 3 months?
Yes.
Christine, you've taken these tests multiple times. Let's begin with you. I'm sure the others would like to respond also.
I think that probably there's a great danger in taking the test over and over again because it's a very capricious test. It's not measuring the presence of HIV itself. There's no test that look for or detect HIV. The antibody test is looking for one form of substitute for HIV, in this case antibodies, that supposedly represent the presence of the virus itself. But the antibody tests, like the DNA tests, have never been validated for their ability to distinguish who's truly infected through the detection of these substitutes by the direct purification of the virus from people who test positive for these substitutes. In other words, it's an unvalidated test. And I think the more times you take it, the greater chances you develop of coming up positive sooner or later. Also, at most test sites, they ask for data. They ask for information about yourself. Are you at risk? That affects how your test is read. Are you practicing this kind of sex or that kind of sex, which affects how your test results are read? These results don't come back yes or no, black or white, so to speak. They're all open to interpretation, which makes them dangerous as well. So I would think that before this person goes out and does this testing again, they might want to find out what it is they're engaging in. It's a kind of a form of medical Russian roulette. And there's information at the Alive and Well website at aliveandwell.org about this recent announcement, and also a lot of information about HIV tests themselves, including an outstanding $50,000 Fact Finder Award. And that $50,000 is offered in exchange for a copy of a single scientific study from the mainstream medical literature that gives us a basis for the assumption that testing positive for substitutes for HIV means a person is actually HIV infected.
Mm-hmm.
That award has been in place and unclaimed for over a year now, and its announcement was sent out to AIDS activists, the U.S. Center for Disease Control employees, the National Institutes of Health employees, et cetera, and no one thus far has been able to produce a single study that validates, scientifically speaking, these surrogate marker tests as reliable substitutes for finding the virus itself in people. That leads me to assume, at this point anyway, without further evidence, there's no scientific or ethical basis for calling people HIV infected who come up positive for these substitutes.
David, you, your response to the idea, someone in a committed relationship so paranoid that he retests an antibody assay every 3 months?
Well, I agree with Christine that the tests are capricious. Just yesterday, a report was released by the Centers for Disease Control indicating big problems with what they're calling rapid tests. These have been heavily promoted by the CDC. Come in, get your test, learn in 5 minutes whether you're positive or not. They've had to stop using these tests in New York City because every once in a while they get a burst of false positive tests. Now, that term itself is interesting because what they do is if they get a positive test and they tell the person you're probably HIV positive, then they do what's called a Western blot. And if that's negative, I guess they phone the person back and say, oops, sorry, you're not really positive. And, of course, that gets to be a bit embarrassing when you have to do it several times a day. But the Western blot itself has no confirmatory test. So if the Western blot produces a false positive, nobody knows. So they just simply call every positive test on a Western blot a true positive because they have no way of telling. I mean, that's a horrible thing to think that they might be telling people that they're infected with a fatal virus when they're not, just because they have no way to know if the test is truly or falsely positive. So I just think getting tested for HIV the first time is a mistake, and to do it regularly is virtually suicide, because eventually you're going to test positive.
All right. I see somebody's getting rather happy over there with the cell phone. Let me put the same question to you, Zahudi, before we get a follow-up from our sister, Ayadora. Brother Zahudi, if you were talking to this black man in a committed relationship, and he told you that he needed to get HIV antibody tested every 3 months, how would you respond to him without using the N-word?
Well, I would instruct him to the biblical prophet Job. And I would recite Job saying that the thing I have feared has come upon me. Basically, what you fear will appear. And it is not wise to be ignorant, especially in today's age of information, to be ignorant with this thing called the law of attraction, because, what you think about consistently, religiously, you magnify. And everything on the mental level has a physical equivalent. So it is just a matter of time before this person attracts this fraudulent thing unto himself, be it HIV or AIDS, whereby he is prescribed medication that will actually break his system down and give him the physical of the thing he has feared through his ignorance.
That's right, that's right. Viador, did you have a follow-up comment or question?
I just want to say that I think the brother is an idiot, but I feel sorry for the sister because she really, like, checked for him. She is at wit's end because she is adamant that she's not going to do this, but it also means that she's probably going to lose him in the process. You know?
Yeah, well, that may be subject matter for a relationship program.
I will host it with you.
Yeah. Well, I would suggest that you get to her some information, relative to the failure of the test and the failure of the hypothesis. This story, now appearing in mainstream press, confirmed by the World Health Organization itself, it says that the threat of heterosexual AIDS outside of sub-Saharan Africa doesn't exist. And so, therefore, he's not in sub-Saharan Africa, so he would then make a logical calculation that his fears and anxieties were unfounded. If then he should still persist in his fears and anxieties, then you probably would be right that this is probably not a good man for a good woman to be with, and then we can have that relationship discussion. Follow-up comment or question as we go forward.
I just want to say thanks to you and Christine, and who said Daniel, and Tahuti for your response. And I did go to the website and printed out some information for her.
Okay.
And I'm going to direct her to it, and hopefully she can make a very better informed decision.
And lastly, if you would want to pass on to her my telephone number, have him call me.
Okay.
Thank you, Valetta.
Okay.
All right. We have a couple of emails that are coming. I'd like to share. The first email comes to us from Ia Ajua. She writes, Hotep, Brother Kitty, Asante Sana, which is Swahili for thank you very much, and to your guests for sharing this valuable information. How can we, who are conscious of these fake medical scares, assist our fellow unconscious Africans, continental and diasporan, to understand the connection between the hype and population control? Are not these medical frauds, fake hypes, and other aspects of the pollution-based environmental conditions, poisonous foods we consume from corporate kitchens, chemtrails, etc., all of which used to control populations so that the have-mores can continue to have more? They're from Ia Ajua. So really two questions and the same question. How can we do a better job of, you know, convincing people that this hype and these things are really people control measures?
I think it's really important to spread the word, to share as much as possible with people this information, these websites, the films and books that exist, and to maybe bring these discussions to professional groups, students, to social groups, to community groups, and to churches, which have become kind of indoctrinated into this whole unhealthy HIV equals AIDS paradigm. Churches are being used as testing sites. Churches are being infused with money from the Centers for Disease Control to round up people in black communities, frankly. You don't see this going on at white churches. To get people to test, to get people to be responsible, so to speak, and take the treatments if they do come up positive on these tests that can't even tell you if, in fact, you have the virus. So I think it's important to go to these establishments, these places and groups and just wherever anyone can within their own community and think outside that, too, perhaps to larger national organizations and open the topic of discussion, spread the word, send links, send a few articles, have a screening at your home of one of the many documentaries that exist on this topic or at a local library. I think by doing that, every social change movement has started from what I've seen from the bottom up, so to speak, from people who bring it around to other people, and it becomes undeniable at a certain point, and then and only then do the leaders engage. So I think it's up to us to put this out there in the general consciousness and make it a part of a lot of discussions on a lot of different levels.
All right. Jehudi, since the specific question was specifically about how do we get quote-unquote unconscious Africans to put this in a larger context, would you like to respond?
Yes. We have to work to perform a flip-flop of unconsciousness. Unconsciousness, which is consciousness. For me, I would just simply advocate a return to common sense, a return to reason, which is the ability to think and understand and draw conclusions, because the greatest authority is the authority within ourselves, you know, and not outside authority. That's what got us messed up in the first place, trusting people because they had initials behind their names, MD, and all these other things here. And we made them the authority, the outside authority, which nullified common sense, which nullified reason, you know. And again, that's what got us into this mess. So education, information, enlightenment, you know, return to common sense, you know, use of the mind. We all have brains. If you're on planet Earth and you have a functioning brain, there's no excuse. There is no excuse. So education, information, consciousness. And let's live by example. You know, I'm around a lot of people, and I've helped a lot of people over the year just by how I carry myself. You know, there's no fear of anything. Why? Because I have knowledge. Knowledge and the application of knowledge knocks out fear, which is predicated upon ignorance. It's simple as that.
Okay. It does sound very practical. There's another email that's coming in. This one from T.I. My question is, should blacks not be tested? What if you meet someone and decide to marry? How will you find out their status? David.
Well, I guess the first thing to decide is the HIV test meaningful? If the HIV test is unambiguous evidence of a fatal virus, then obviously you'd want to know if a future sexual partner has this fatal virus. So the question boils down to, is this what the HIV test is testing for? And I think attitude needs to be, let me get a lot of information and think it through for myself, not look for the person with the highest status who's going to tell me the truth. I think that's a fundamental flaw. If you decide that the Centers for Disease Control or the World Health Organization or, you know, some other organization is a source of unbiased, unambiguous truth, then you're going to do what they want you to do. If you get a variety of information and think it through for yourself, you may come to a surprising conclusion. You may conclude that you agree with the increasing number of scientists who question the accuracy of HIV tests and whether this disease, this syndrome called AIDS, is really a meaningful concept or not. And if you do that, you'd say, well, what I need to do is educate my partner on the meaninglessness of these tests, not to encourage them to get tested. And I need to explain to him or her why neither of us should get tested and why getting tested would have enormous social consequences and could destroy our life, our ability to have children, our ability to have a normal sexual life. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, what people need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Katie, I don't know if you discussed prior to my arrival on the show the racial bias inherent in HIV testing.
That is so, so very important. Before we go to that, can I just briefly respond to T.I.'s questions?
Sure.
I'll make it very brief, and then let's go into that racial bias. T.I., I would say, first of all, to your question, should blacks not be tested? Blacks, Hispanics, Asians, Europeans, no one should be tested with phony, fake, fraudulent diagnostic techniques. It is my conclusion, based upon analysis of this process for some time, including reading package inserts that accompany these tests from several manufacturers, it is my conviction that these HIV antibody assays are largely a fraud. If the assays were being used only to measure hypergammaglobulinemia, meaning you have too much free-floating antibody material in your blood, then the test would be valuable. But then they would say, well, what is the gamma globulin for? I don't know. There's just a whole bunch of it. But these tests, from my perspective, are a fraud. So no one should be tested using a fraudulent technique. She says, what if you meet someone, and I'm going to make a presumption he means me. What if you meet someone and decide to marry? How will you find out their status? I will look deep into her eyes. I will touch her gently on the sides of her face. And I will say, baby, do you love me? If she says yes, I will know her status. Not a dry eye in the house. Everybody choked up at the same time. Okay, since y'all didn't respond to that, I thought that was real poignant. Dang, can't we have a little fun over here, a little levity?
that's real, Kitty. You use yourself as a divination tool.
That's right. That's right. Continue that, and then we're going to go to Christine's point about the bias of the test. The divination tool. Talk to us, brothers. Hootie, my Aunt Ra.
I mean, without a doubt, you know, we are divination tools ourselves. Most people think of the crystals, the pendulums, and things, and that's all cool. But, you know, human beings, you know, we're creatures of energy, so therefore, you know, we can pick up energy. Therefore, we're divination tools. It's like myself, you know, with my wife. You know, there was no testing. You know, I'm the type of person like this, Kitty. You know, what type of testing was done, you know, 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago? You know, I mean, what has really happened in our world to the point that, you know, whole civilizations and the functions and the things that, you know, we did as people within civilizations changed, you know? It's like, what happened? You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, certificates. You know, you got to get blood tests. You got to get certificates. You got to do all these. Who came up with that? You know, how come we're not asking ourselves, who came up with that and why? You know, what purpose does it really serve? It all goes back to control. So I've never asked a woman, you know, do you have AIDS, what have you. First of all, I believe in courting people. I'm an herbalist, okay? I'm a metaphysician. You know, I'm a diviner. You know what I'm saying? So I pick up energy. And if a person did believe they were infected with some type of health challenge, you cannot be with an herbalist such as myself and not improve your health. You're not, you couldn't be with me and not maintain and sustain optimal health and well-being. I think the greatest thing of all is just truth, okay? Truth, you know? And if we have to go deeper, again, common sense, reason, and all these other things here, you know? Well, what is AIDS, you know? A symptom of what type of diseases, you know? Hepatitis, well, what is hepatitis? HEPA is Latin for liver. Itis is inflammation. What causes inflammation? Mucus, which is snot. Where does that come from? It comes from the diet. Okay, change the diet. I mean, we deduce, people. It's not that difficult.
That's not.
Not at all.
I don't think any one of us could improve on that response. So let's go forward to the subject, Christine, you just introduced, that this antibody assay process, actually there is an ethnic and or blood-related bias in this testing?
Yes, this is not something from my own worker observation, but that of Professor Henry Bauer, who's an emeritus professor of science at the University of, I think it's Polytechnic University in Virginia.
Virginia Tech.
Thank you, David. He's written a book called The Origin, Persistence, and Failings of the HIV/AIDS Theory, and in it he points out how the tests don't work. They don't work to predict where AIDS will be. They don't work to tell anyone if they're actually infected with the virus. And of most concern, I would think, to people of color is the darker your skin, the more possibility of testing positive, and not due to any kind of, quote, risk behavior. Simply the physical makeup of people of certain origins are such that these responses on these nonspecific tests tend toward positive. And this is across the board. He points out that if you take a group of expectant mothers, you will find the highest number of positives and considerably higher positives among blacks. If you take a group of hospitalized patients for X, Y, or Z disease, you will find the highest number of positive test results among blacks. Young people, old people, rich people, poor people. It comes out the same, that there's something about these tests that respond to the genetic makeup of the blood. And people who come from certain areas of the world have a greater possibility or propensity towards testing positive. He even points out how on the West Coast, people of color have a different ethnic origin from those on the East Coast, and East Coast blacks test positive more often than West Coast blacks.
Okay.
It's remarkable and very, mm-hmm. very important, and there's a breakdown of this discussion, again, at the Alive and Well website at aliveandwell.org under the subject heading of the UN WHO announcement that there is no heterosexual AIDS pandemic except among blacks, basically. Mm-hmm. If you scroll down, you'll get to a radio interview with myself and Henry Bauer and some very, very interesting commentary from Henry Bauer. And then for people who want to know more about his specific work in this area, he has a website all about his book, The Origin, Persistence, and Failings of the HIV-AIDS Theory, and there's a link to that directly in the link section at the aliveandwell.org website.
Okay. Well, I hope you don't mind if I replay that audio of the link with you and Henry Bauer.
No, my goodness, not at all.
Dynamite, dynamite. Well, we're going to make sure we get that right on. And going forward, let's just see if we can focus in on why the bias. Now, again, perhaps, David, you would like to explain to people, what does the so-called HIV test for?
Well, people are still mostly tested for HIV using antibody tests, and in North America, generally it will be three so-called ELISA tests where all the supposed HIV proteins are put together into one area, and a positive test, a test is considered reactive or positive if there's a color change beyond a certain density. If two out of those three tests are positive, the color change is greater than the limit, then a Western blot is done. And in the Western blot, the proteins are separated. And there are several different ways to analyze this Western blot, so it's possible to be positive on one and not on another. If this Western blot is reactive, then the entire grouping of tests are called a positive HIV test. Now, in Africa, you might only get one test, and it might be only a rapid test. I mentioned earlier that they had to stop using rapid tests in New York because they had sometimes too high a risk of false positivity, even using the Western blot as the standard, which is by itself has no way to be validated. Clearly, in Africa, this will multiply the number of people who test positive because studies showed with antibody tests in the 1980s that of the people who tested positive on the first ELISA test, only about half would test positive on the second, and only about half again on the third. So you've immediately dropped the number of people by eight by doing three tests, and including the Western blot. You know, there's only a small fraction of people who will actually get through the entire testing process and come out positive on the other side. If you only do one test, you're going to see a rate of seropositivity that's several times higher. Another test that's quite commonly used now is known as the viral load test. This is based on the polymerase chain reaction, which was invented by Kerry Mullis in the 1980s. In fact, he got the Nobel Prize in 1993 for chemistry for the invention of the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. This was initially a manufacturing technique. It was designed so that you could take a single strand of DNA, and by the end of the afternoon, you could have billions of virtually identical strands of DNA. So its use as a test is a little bit problematical. It's a little bit like trying to estimate the size of a nuclear bomb by the size of the mushroom cloud it produces. PCR is an exponential growth of DNA. At each stage, the amount of DNA doubles. And so a small error early in the process will have a big influence on the amount that's produced at the end. What they do is they measure the amount of DNA produced after a certain amount of time, and then they claim that that represents the amount that was there initially. And based on the estimate of viral load, they imply that they know how many viral particles are in your blood. There are just many problems with this.
Mm-hmm.
The first being that they've never purified HIV. So how do they know what the RNA or the DNA associated with HIV is if they don't have pure material to work from in the first place?
Let me just I'm going to return to the question about why the bias of the testing process, but I'm going to put a little different spin on it, Jehudi. There are many blacks, brother, who believe that the reason that this is impacting black people disproportionately is because this is the end consequence of a scientific experiment and recombinant DNA, and that there was a germ that was specifically engineered to seek out and destroy black people. How do you respond, Jehudi, to people who make that suggestion to you?
Well, the other guest did a remarkable job of explaining the AIDS test. You know me, Katie, you know, Mr. Layman.
Correct.
I mean, I just break it down in just simple terms that, you know, I truly believe that African Americans are just targeted because there's just this collectively held view that we are ignorant, gullible people and who will go for anything, you know. I think a lot of it has to do, you know, with our conditions, our habits and things like that, you know. I would say an insalubrious insalubrious health style or lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And in regards to the question you just threw out at me, as far as things done in laboratories and things like that, I won't dismiss it, but at the same time, I would say it's partially true because I do believe in eugenics, you know, and I've researched on experiments done in this country that target black people. I know we're all, for the most part, aware of or should be aware of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment and other experiments with the black children that was done by, I believe, Kaiser Permanente and, mm-hmm. and just a whole list of experiments, you know. So, you know, I would say it's partially true. But then on the flip side of that, you know, it just stems from ignorance, you know. Why is it that the black churches, the black Christians are the only ones buying into this HIV/AIDS hype, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't see that at these churches. I'm in the San Fernando Valley. I don't see that in Glendale. I don't see that in Toluca Lake. You know, I'm not seeing that in Burbank, Studio City, Encino, Tarzana. I don't see that. You go to South Central Los Angeles on Crenshaw Boulevard, there are big billboards, you know, free HIV testing, AIDS testing, you know. A lot of it also has to do with sex, you know, and sexuality. And, you know, we do have this image here in America, and I'm not saying that it's a real image, but we do have this image that we are very sexually promiscuous people. You know, I was doing some more research last week on AIDS and black women. And, you know, the statistics, man, they're clearly biased, man. I mean, it's like black women are the only sexually promiscuous, you know, females in the country, are the only females who engage in sex way more than any other female of any other type of race or nationality, you know. And it goes right back to this collective view of being a victim, you know, this black victim. And that's what I would say in response to your question.
Okay.
You asked what the test tests for, mm-hmm. and I don't think that was ever really answered.
Well, David got a little technical, which we
sorry
know.
About
we
can, that.
Well, no need to apologize. We have to approach this at all levels. And I do agree, and I think maybe we could have done like Tahuti does, break it down in lay person's language. So, and I wanted to respond to that also, why the bias. But, Christine, why don't you answer that question, and then I'm going to return to why the bias.
Well, I think it's important to recognize what the tests don't test for, which is HIV. They don't make any claims to be able to test for the virus itself. They're not looking for any HIV-specific markers. What they measure is a person's antibody response to a series of proteins thought to be part of or to represent HIV that aren't HIV. And I think we can say more about what the test doesn't do than what it does do because we don't know. It cross-reacts with a variety of conditions that produce antibodies that have nothing to do with HIV, that have nothing to do with risk behavior, and give positive results. For example, people who receive blood transfusions have a propensity for testing positive. Women who've been pregnant more than once have a greater chance of testing positive. And as we said, people of certain ethnic makeup have a greater chance of testing positive because these tests are nonspecific. They're looking for things that don't have anything specifically uniquely to do with HIV. And I think it's really important to recognize what they're not doing. They're called HIV tests, but they're not testing for HIV. Like the viral load is called a viral load test. That's like a brand name. That's like a Whopper. That implies that it's a really big hamburger. Viral load implies that you're getting this load of virus, but the test itself says this test is not intended to be used as a screening test for HIV or as a diagnostic to confirm the presence of HIV infection. We know more about what the tests can't do and what they don't do and what they're not testing for than we do about what they are testing for. And given that, I think it's a good reason to exercise a lot of caution and thought when it comes to considering, you know, partaking in their use.
Very good point that you're making. Once again, returning to the issue of the bias, when we look at what the tests are actually measuring, it is excess of gamma globulin, or immune antibody protein. And if we look at what could be the triggers for higher and higher levels of immune protein, we're going to examine a whole bunch of environmental stressors, if I could use the language of our beloved brother, Dr. Roberto Giraldo.
Roberto also did an experiment that was very interesting when he was working as a HIV testing clinician at Cornell. He took blood of people who had come up HIV negative and found that undiluted, the HIV antibody test, for reasons that is not explained in the test kit literature or the medical literature, requires an unusual dilution rate, some 300 times dilution, whereas other antibody tests are tests on what is called neat serum, that is undiluted serum, or serum that's been diluted in small parts, maybe up to 30 times or 40 times at best. And he found that the HIV test, or so-called HIV test, requires dilution by more than 300 times.
That's right.
And when he took undiluted blood of people who had tested negative, what he found, they all tested positive. So clearly this indicates that there's something inherent in human blood that reacts on these tests. And in order to prevent the entire population from testing positive, they can't use the test on neat or straight serum. It has to be diluted. And I've talked with other experts in the field, for instance, Dr. Rodney Richards, who's a PhD organic chemist who was a fundamental part of the development of the first so-called HIV antibody test. And what he told me is these tests were calibrated early on to make it so that people didn't test positive in great numbers who fell outside of risk groups. That is, healthy blood donors. You couldn't have those people coming up positive to a great extent. So they kept diluting it and diluting it and diluting it until they got what they wanted, which was enough people in so-called risk groups testing positive, with some collateral damage to people outside of those risk groups, of some of those testing positive too. But that's where this comes from. And if you look at the test kit literature, too, you'll see that the way they establish the specificity and sensitivity, those are two terms that when you put them together, they describe a test's accuracy. The way they decided that these tests were accurate was literally this. If you tested a bunch of people with AIDS illnesses and they came up positive, that meant they had the virus, and you could assume they were infected. And if you tested a bunch of healthy people and they came up negative, you could assume they didn't have the virus and weren't infected. And that is literally the science behind HIV testing, assumptions and presumptions based on positive reactions in sick people, and this highly diluted test that was calibrated in its development to prevent too many people who don't fit the profile from coming up positive.
Yeah, so very true, very true. Last point I'll make about the bias of these testing processes is that there is a poverty bias. poor people tend to be more exposed to environmental stressors or environmental toxins than non-poor people. It's in the food. It's in the insecticides and things used in the home. It is in, there are now, has been proven links between psychological stress and the body's immune system. It's now been verified, something we've known organically and intuitively for so long. And so when you combine a broad set of environmental stressors that would impact the lives of people who are poor, and when we look at the disproportion of poor people in this country, and the way that poor people have been urbanized, ghettoized, et cetera, and the way that the testing campaigns have isolated these groups. Someone mentioned about the churches involved. There's an official program called the Balm in Gilead, using some old biblical terminology, to suck in these money-grubbing, greedy, these ministers, these African-American churches. Ooh, I almost started cussing there. When we look at the way this has been set up, we can see that a broad base of things, and I specifically mentioned 9 reasons why African-American women are being called the new face of AIDS in America. When we put them all together, we can see there is bias in the system. We're nearing to the point where we're going to have to move on with the program, but we do have a few more minutes. Anybody want to respond to anything I was talking about the bias? Oh, and the last point I'll mention is, it could very well also be an RH factor bias on the test. We do recognize that military research has shown us that there are identifiable RH distinctions between people of different biological phenotypes, the so-called 5 races of mankind.
One thing I could say, I was privy to some documents during a legal case in Canada last year, and one of them was what they called the HIV testing flow chart. And at the very beginning of the flow chart, it had a decision: is this person in a risk group or not? And if that person was in a risk group, a completely different series of tests. And one could imagine that those would create a much higher risk of being positive. So, for example, if somebody was homosexual, or a black immigrant to Canada, or perhaps subject to a criminal investigation, they may get a different series of tests. But at the end, they will just be called HIV positive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another area where bias can enter, is, you know, which tests are done based on who you are.
All right. We have more emails and a telephone call. Call is always having priority. Caller, your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, brothers. Amasis Ma'at, Amiri Empire.
Greetings, brother Amasis Ma'at. Christine Jehuti and David are with us. What's on your mind today?
What's on my mind is that way that things are being attacked to us, as far as specifically the black community, the global black community, and that we're seemingly like the perceived weaker opponent compared to the white gay right political action committee, that they have more power as far as this issue is. So my question is, for anyone that's on the panel that is connected to that political action committee, is there any way that they are positioned to help the African nation building? And if so, in what way?
Jehudi, you want to respond to that first?
Hoping the African nations, continental Africans. Wow. In all due honesty, beloved, you know, most of my work is aimed here in America because I know that our people, you know, on the continent, you know, in the motherland are watching us. You know, they look to us, you know, for guidance. And I know there's some friction there. But from my personal experience, I deal with a lot of Africans, by the way, Uganda, Kenya, you know, and it's really amazing. But I deal with so many of them, including doctors, if you will. And in all due honesty, man, it's quite challenging, man, because, you know, a lot of Africans, they really embrace the Western allopathic medicine paradigm, man. I mean, they really embrace that. I mean, they'll even go against the Bush people. They're, you know, herbalists, you know, who have been knocking out all type of health challenges for centuries, you know, but they're adamant in that, you know, certain diseases such as your so-called viral infections or conditions are incurable and will outright bite you, you know. So I don't know. You know, I know talking to Dr. Sabi, you know, he expressed the same sentiments that our people in the motherland, the majority of them, especially those in college, the educated, you know, and those who happen to be doctors, they will fight you, you know, on this stance that, you know, certain diseases don't exist or they're, in fact, curable or healable, you know. So, I you know, it's going to have to be in the area of education. Now, how that's going to be done at this point right now, it's like I really don't know because, I mean, truth is truth, facts is facts. And if a person disagrees, they just disagree. You can bring a horse to water, but you can't force them to drink. But that's just from my personal dealings with Africans on the continent there, you know. So, again, my work here is mainly with African Americans or members of the black community, and I've been doing a very good job, and I've been working with consciousness and helping people to become enlightened, dealing with reason, common sense, and things like that. I just put out an AIDS and HIV article a couple of months ago, you know, that really did wonders, you know. It really woke a lot of people up there. And so that's what I'm going to continue to bank on, and I'm going to deal with our people here in America first and foremost, and hopefully many of those will make the trip or the journey to the motherland and begin educating. I mean, Europeans, Africa was first dominated by Europeans thanks to the missionaries.
And so we're nearing the end of the program, Jody, so we have to make a response for you.
So basically I would say, you know, we're going to have some educational missionaries.
All right. Amasis, I guess, as you had written that question in, is the gay PAC, Political Action Committee, positioned to help African nation building? If so, in what way? That was the gist of your question.
Yeah, but I wanted to make it clear that the white gay right Political Action Committee, what I'm focusing on, is they are basically just they're helping themselves, or they have it since they know that they've been helped through the civil rights movement, that or they an agenda come back and help us. Specifically.
Okay. And can we take your response off the air?
Yes, please.
All right. Thank you so much. Christine, you and I, and during the course of our studies over the years, we used to gather over there in Santa Monica Park, our brother Tariq, myself, yourself, and hundreds of others. And there was a significant presence of gay males there in that process. I thought it was empowering to attend these meetings and get this information to study. From what I was able to understand, of all those meetings I used to go to, Brother Tariq and myself were the only black heterosexual males to attend those meetings. We came back to our community firing up, infused with energy and information to teach. Let me just ask you, Christine, based upon what you know about how the gay community organizes within itself, Do you think that they have used that information for their own group survival? And secondly, according to Amos's question, are they then prepared to use what they've learned and developed to rescue Africa?
I don't see that happening, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
When the meetings that you're referring to, there were very few heterosexual male blacks who came to our meetings, unfortunately. Well, we held them in West Hollywood Park because AIDS at that time was of primary interest to the white male gays living there.
Mm-hmm.
They were the targeted group, or, you know, even though it became politically incorrect to say that, you know, that's how they felt and that's what their experience was and that's how the marketing campaigns went. You still can't pick up a magazine directed toward that demographic without finding ad after ad to get tested, get treated, sell your life insurance. It's all about AIDS, and it is so ingrained into the gay culture as a rallying cry, the testing as a rite of passage, the money that comes into various organizations under the auspices of AIDS goes to fund everything from, you know, social programs to swimming pools at you know, gay and lesbian centers. Mm-hmm. It's a big, huge cash cow.
Are they willing to share that cash cow to help
advocates? See that happening, because in order to keep the cash cow grazing, in order to keep the funds flowing, you have to agree with the notion of, you know, mainstream AIDS, that
now,
you know, the tests are accurate, the mm-hmm. drugs are good, and it used to be the mainstream AIDS adage was everyone is at risk. Now, as of June 8th, it's back to this is a disease, so to speak, of gay men, IV drug users, and blacks. But unless you're on the program, you're not going to get the money, and I don't see any real, I don't know, breaking up of mm-hmm. that kind of entrenched thinking around this.
Two quick questions. I'm having to push everything for time's sake. We're going to end the program real quick. Two quick questions to you, Christine. One is, do you believe that Baum and are you familiar with the Baum and Gilead movement targeting black churches, and have you attempted to contact any of these black ministers?
I have, and I got real nasty responses.
Okay. Secondly, Christine, according to your research, and I know you are up on this, David, you may have these figures also, what is the current annual budget for African-American AIDS advocacy programs?
Boy, I don't have the answer to that question, but I know that there's lots of money going to churches and barber shops, and like what the gentleman you have on the air, Jehudi, what he said about, you know, I live apparently in the same area, Toluca Lake, Glendale, Burbank. You don't see any signs like this. You don't have churches running testing clinics. For 8 years, I had a business down in the Crenshaw District, and it's all over the place there. It's ridiculous. I don't know what portion of AIDS funding goes to the marketing to the community so-called most at risk, putting them most at risk. But, you know, it's not happening across the board, and there's a reason. And I just think it's real unfortunate that people are so willing to accept government entitlement programs.
They're
willing to accept government money because, you know, the government giveth and taketh away.
Yeah.
And, you know, they giveth you money and they taketh away your right to think.
David, I'm going to put the question to you, and I need a very brief response. Are you aware of the specifics of any U.S. government or U.S. funding specifically for African Americans with HIV/AIDS?
No, I haven't
the promotion
been following that.
Okay.
I think in the gay community, it's more about the individuals who are grabbing the money, not the community itself.
Right. Yeah, I would say, Jehudi, did you want to weigh on that? I think I know what it is.
I agree with it's Christine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
I love it. It's political, so they're going to look out for their own vested interests, and Africans are going to have to come up with their own political action committee.
That's right. Well, I would say, based upon looking for that money, that advocacy money, we do know that $156 million was allocated in 1998 at a specific request of Congresswoman Maxine Waters. I told her not to do it. She did it anyways. And Bill Clinton signed an executive order. The money, I think much of that money was related to Department of Defense funds because of his role as commander-in-chief. He could get the money real easily that way. But it also militarized the HIV/AIDS campaign among African Americans. Later, I think that money was increased, has increased to $400 million approximately annually coming from the federal government on HIV/AIDS campaign specifically targeting African Americans. 400 million was the last number that I was able to come across. We're going to have about 30 seconds apiece to wrap up. Jehudi, if you would like, I could keep you on a little bit longer because I want to talk about health-related solutions to this. But David, we're going to move forward. You have 30 seconds to wrap up and share your contact info.
I'm the president of Rethinking AIDS, RethinkingAIDS.com, and I think the important thing is that people think for themselves and evaluate both sides of the information that's out there. Don't take anybody's word for it. Don't take my word for it. Don't take Katie or Christine's word either. Don't take the CDC's word for it. Think for yourself.
There you go.
Thank you so much, David, and I'm going to make sure you get copies of today's programs.
Lovely to be on again, Katie. Thank you.
All right. Jehudi, can you stick with me for a little bit after we take another break?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So, Christine, you have 30 seconds. For those who want to maintain contact with you, please do so. And your wrap-up statement.
Yeah, I can be reached through aliveandwell.org. There's also a website specifically about my book that I would encourage people who want a simple introduction to this whole topic of discussion that they check this out. The book is called What If Everything You Thought You Knew About AIDS Was Wrong? And the website is whatifeverything.com. And I just want to say that I personally am available to speak with, work with any groups anywhere in the world I can possibly reach, African Americans, Africa in the motherland, anywhere at any time. I've spoken with various groups before, including the American Association of Physicians in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. I'm always willing and always happy to discuss this, to even debate. Please just contact me if I can be of help.
Yeah, and I will say you and I have been shoulder to shoulder on some incredible front lines on this.
Reverend Al Sharpton's Action Network.
That was a truly, truly historic meeting, and what a day it was. We'll never forget that. Thank you so much, Christine, for all you do and all you continue to do. And I'll make sure you get copies of today's program.
Thank you so much.
All right.
You take care. You've just heard a broadcast from June 19th, 2008 with myself, Christine Maggiore, and David Crow on the Lib Radio program with Kitty Awadu. And during that program, one of the things that we discussed was the notion that male circumcision prevents HIV transmission among black people. And on that program, I mentioned that most of the world's males are anatomically intact. They have the same exact physiology as their counterparts in South Africa, yet only in South Africa is circumcision deemed necessary or important to prevent the so-called transmission of HIV, even though our sexually active people on all continents of the earth, only black people. Here we go again with this odd notion of how black people differ from everyone else in the world. Only among black people does circumcision become necessary and make a difference. And following that broadcast, it came to my attention that there are several papers that were written in May that comment on this issue of circumcision as HIV prevention. And one of them, dated May 20th, 2008, has a headline, Male Circumcision as HIV Prevention Found Ineffective, according to a researcher from the famous Pasteur Institute. The co-discoverer, as we call him, Luc Montagnier, comes from the Pasteur Institute in France. And this paper analyzed 13 studies conducted in African countries and concluded that male circumcision, quote, offers little, if any, protection from so-called HIV infection. And this is one of many papers and many studies coming out that are questioning the notion of circumcision as doing anything except spending health care dollars, risking the health of grown male participants as they participate in this kind of surgery. And so there's another one on May 17th, and on May 6th, male circumcision ineffective in HIV battle. So I think there's a lot to question with regard to that, as evidenced in the mainstream medical literature.
Well, it was also in the journal AIDS in early 2007, I came across three papers. I think a couple of them were in Lancet. The two in Lancet said that the risk of men becoming HIV positive was less when they were circumcised, but a study in the journal AIDS showed that the risk to women was no different, and this is why it's being promoted, and yet it's women who are HIV positive at a higher rate. I mean, these things just don't seem to fit together.
Here's another one that says something about that from February 8, 2008, headline, Wives More Likely to Contract HIV from Circumcised Husbands. And this is a 2-year study of wives of circumcised men, and they found that this took place in Uganda. It was funded by Bill and Melinda Gates, and it found that the wives of circumcised men were 58 times more likely to test HIV positive than the wives of men who were anatomically intact. And the Gates principal investigator said the results were, quote, unexpected and somewhat disappointing, which I think is a phrase they can keep using over and over again as these vaccines fail. That was unexpected and somewhat disappointing. The microbicides fail. That was somewhat unexpected and disappointing. So here we go again with unexpected and disappointing when it comes to validating these assumptions about HIV and AIDS and so-called transmission.
But, you know, it doesn't stop them doing this research. There seems to be a lot of research going on circumcision.
And it certainly doesn't stop them from removing foreskin.
No. They seem to love snipping this and that, and any intervention is good. Non-intervention is always bad because you never get money out of not doing anything.
And pardon me if I emphasize this again, but I just find it difficult to believe that the whole world is watching this happen and doesn't raise a question about why black males? What is the difference between uncircumcised men in South Africa or Uganda and the vast majority of uncircumcised men that live in South America, Central America, Mexico, New Zealand, Australia, Europe?
Yes.
Everywhere else in the world. What is the difference? What makes a black penis so unique that it needs to be mutilated in some form in the name of HIV/AIDS prevention?
Well, one of the dangers of this kind of epidemiological research is that circumcision is a social thing. It goes along with certain cultures. Some cultures circumcise, some don't. And therefore, there are many other things that go along with that culture that could raise the risk of false positive or true positive, if there is such a thing, HIV tests. And so it's perhaps not surprising that they may find these trends in people that, you know, in a country that's mainly circumcised, maybe has a lower rate of HIV seropositive positivity than in another, but when they actually start the manipulations where they actually start circumcising people who wouldn't normally be circumcised in their culture, they don't find it makes any difference. Or sometimes it seems to make a small difference, other times it's no difference, other times it's negative, which indicates that really circumcision has nothing to do with this, it's other things.
Right. I just want to read from an article that coincidentally came out in Mothering Magazine. It is the July-August 2008 issue, and the headline under the banner Mothering says, circumcision does not prevent HIV. So they're attuned to this fact of the efforts to prevent so-called transmission are not affected by circumcision. But in here, there's a summary statement about circumcision worldwide, and I just wanted to mention that I think New Zealand, yes, here it is. Less than 1% of males in New Zealand are circumcised. 2.3% in England. So this is very, very low rates of circumcised males.
Right.
Yet, do we have AIDS epidemics in New Zealand? Do we
Right.
have AIDS epidemics among heterosexuals in the UK? Quite the opposite.
And England in particular, I mean, I know that New Zealand has a small black community, but England has a huge black community. So if this was the issue, you'd expect it to be everywhere by now, and it's not.
Yeah, so, let's see. So it's not affecting black, okay, being sarcastic maybe here.
Yeah, that's
or
okay.
Or not. I mean, it's hard to tell sometimes what's sarcasm when it comes to HIV and AIDS because so little of it makes any sense. So just to summarize here, black people in South Africa, black males in South Africa are particularly at risk, but black males in England are not. And why would that be so?
Well, it would tell you there's something else going on that's
Maybe
not the circumcision.
Maybe they're better fed, they have clean water and access to basic
right.
medical care, they're not dealing with civil wars and droughts
right.
and so forth.
Right. And, you know, cultures like in Malawi, the culture was reoriented towards a corn-based economy based on a dictatorial president a number of years ago. And, of course, a corn-based diet leads to vitamin deficiencies, vitamin B deficiencies that are easily mistaken for AIDS, especially with the weak definition of AIDS in Africa.
Right. Isn't Madonna giving some sort of concerted effort to helping the country of Malawi?
Well, it's supposed to be one of the hotbeds of AIDS, which I think is kind of interesting because its agricultural economy was really messed up by this president, and I believe the two major
crops... What, did he own stock in corn? I mean, what's the deal with that?
Well, there's actually an interesting story about the president. He's now dead, but apparently...
presumably from a vitamin deficiency?
Well, I doubt it. I'm sure he had a much better diet. But he went over as a young person to America to be educated, and there's a rumor that the person who came back was not the same person who went over. So I don't know about that. But
in a metaphorical sense?
No.
He physically wasn't the same guy.
Somebody took him out and then took his personality and came back in order to rule Malawi. So,
wow.
You know, that's a pretty amazing story. I don't know how true that is, but I just thought I'd bring it up because I love... things like that.
Obscure facts that may not be factual.
yes. But what is factual is that he turned the country towards a corn and tobacco-based economy. And in most countries, it's the indigenous agricultural products that are much more nutritious. They're not as high yielding. And so a lot of people who want a modern agricultural economy will go for high-yielding crops. But they're often... high-yielding in starch and sugars and not in the other nutrients that are necessary for proper nutrition.
And people certainly can't eat tobacco.
No. I mean, it's a great export crop, but it's not doing much good for the poor because they end up living on plantations, often owned by landowners, eating a diet mostly based on corn.
Yeah. But I wonder if Madonna's thought of providing people there with food instead of more so-called HIV testing and more the toxic, expensive treatment drugs that are...
Well, we should have a whole show just on some of these media stars, you know, Annie Lennox, Madonna, people like that who are promoting this agenda and clearly don't have much knowledge about the science behind what they're...
Yeah, I think it'd be great to... take what the various celebrities are doing and analyze what it is exactly they do and how that may be making things potentially worse, certainly not better.
Yes. And
but it'd be interesting to break it down one by one, see what Bono's up to and Elton John, what's he up to these days?
Yes. Unfortunately, I think these people are so far removed from... the science, everything is so highly filtered for them, and they, you know, honestly want to make change, and they're being convinced if you buy drugs like AZT that that's making a positive change, and they have no idea what AZT does and how that makes it so toxic.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose, too, once you've taken a very public position on this, the most difficult thing in the world would be to stop and question whether that highly public position and one that you've invested years and millions of dollars in is the best position to be taking.
Yeah, I think there's that. Plus, they would have to directly contradict their advisors who they have developed a very close personal relationship with. So it'd be pretty hard for somebody who's brought an MD on to advise them to then turn around and say, you know, you're totally, utterly wrong and your advice is just causing death and destruction in Africa, not helping people.
Yeah, that would be a hard one to announce over dinner.
Yes, but another unexpected and unfortunate event which was also mentioned on the Katie discussion, was the high level of false positive HIV tests with the OraSure or OraQuick tests. I'm reading here from the Centers for Disease Control, June 18th. That was the day before we talked to Katie, so this was really new then. In late 2005, an unexpected increase in the number of false positive oral fluid tests occurred, but the increase subsided after several months. In December 2005, while the cluster was being investigated, the New York City Department of Health Bureau of STD Control suspended oral fluid testing for 3 weeks and replaced it with fingerstick whole blood rapid testing, which produced no false positive test results. Highly questionable statement, that. On December 21st, they resumed it, but again in late late 2007, another large increase in the incidence of false positive oral fluid rapid test results was observed. Now, they define a false positive relative to the ELISA and Western blot. So if somebody tests positive on the rapid test and then later negative on ELISA or Western blot, they call it a false positive. Of course, they have no way to validate the ELISA and Western blot tests, so even their true positives aren't necessarily really true. But a little later, what came to my attention was that OraSure, despite this debacle in New York City, is opening the NASDAQ stock exchange on June 27th, which is apparently National HIV Testing Day. So what's the message here? Well, as long as OraSure or OraQuick are selling lots of tests and making lots of money, the stock exchange is enthusiastic. They don't really care if they work or not. It's a question of your sales, not anything else.
That's remarkable that there could be this problem with false positives on that test. And, I mean, to open on the stock market in the midst of a crisis or a scandal with false positives, that's pretty bold.
Yeah, and you wonder what happens to people who get these false positive tests. Like, how many of these people don't bother coming back because, hey, I'm positive, you know. I mean, they trust these tests. How many people went into deep depression or even after they're told they're negative, you know, kind of still think deep down inside them, well, maybe that's not true. Maybe I'm really positive. I mean, it's an incredibly destructive diagnosis to make.
I think, too, there's the overriding issue here is what does a test test for anyway? It's not testing for the virus itself. It's not detecting the virus itself. It's not looking for the virus itself. Nor has any kind of test, whether it's an OraSure or an ELISA or a Western blot, none of these have ever been validated by the direct purification of HIV itself from anyone who tests positive on these various screening tests. So there's who knows what a positive test result means, and who knows what's a true positive, and who knows what's a false positive. We've never established that these tests, when they're looking for antibodies or scraps of RNA and DNA, that when they get a positive result in the identification of the protein response or the RNA or DNA, that this really means that someone has an infection. There's no study out there that says, well, when we find the positive reaction on the antibody test, we know that in 98% of the cases, people actually have an active viral infection. No such study. So, you know, the whole notion of false positives asks the bigger question of what is a true positive. And until there's some validation of these tests, to a certain extent, they're all false positives.
Well, we're going to have to do a future podcast episode on HIV testing. I think our next one's going to be on a somewhat related issue of what is AIDS, which may sound like a stupid question, but I think it's a pretty important question, don't you?
Yeah, most people don't really know. If you ask them what is AIDS, they don't know that it is not a disease in and of itself, that the diseases called AIDS can and do occur among people who don't test positive and don't have so-called AIDS risks, that they've been around long before the definition of AIDS ever emerged, and they have been around and treated in ways that didn't involve the concept of treating HIV. And that the definition of what is AIDS changes from year to year and country to country. And here in the U.S., where I'm speaking from, our AIDS definition includes not being sick.
Well, that's actually quite amazing that the majority of AIDS diagnoses in the United States since 1993 have been in people who have been healthy at the time of their diagnosis, or at least have had no AIDS-defining conditions.
Yeah, no clinical symptoms of illness. Yeah, the overwhelming majority of Americans told they have AIDS since 1993 are people who have no clinical symptoms of disease. And if you remember back in the early 80s when this entire discussion began, AIDS was all about having horrible, intractable, ravaging disease. Now the new AIDS is no disease, just some lab markers. And what's interesting about that is you up there in Canada, you all, you haven't adopted our definition of AIDS. So we could actually send people who've been diagnosed with lab marker AIDS over the border into Canada where they would be undiagnosed or not diagnosed and be AIDS-free just by having moved a few hundred miles or whatever.
And the same goes with America and Africa, because, you know, in Africa, you don't need an HIV test, but there's generic symptoms of illness. And if those people came to America, it's almost certain they would not qualify as AIDS. And these healthy people with AIDS in America going to Africa would almost certainly not qualify as AIDS in Africa. So it's bizarre that you can have a definition in one place that's almost mutually exclusive with the same term in another place.
Yeah, I always think about like a real disease, so to speak. Like if you had gangrene and you lived in Montana, could you move to Manitoba and not have gangrene anymore? I doubt it. If you have cancer and you live in Anaheim, could you move to Calgary and not have cancer anymore? I don't think it works that way.
No, I don't think it does. I think those are what are called real diseases. And with AIDS,
yeah, they don't change
syndrome
when you move across borders, so forth.
Well,
so, was I just being sarcastic?
No. I was just saying that, you know, we're going to have to be careful to end this discussion or we're going to do an impromptu AIDS 101.
Oops, yeah.
Right,
okay,
now.
Well, wait. So, but one thing I wanted to mention when we actually do our broadcast on what is AIDS, we are going to have on the program a couple individuals who were diagnosed as having AIDS while clinically healthy and under some very questionable circumstances.
Wow, that's something I will really look forward to hearing, and I haven't talked to these people, and I'm sure our listeners will really want to hear that too, because it's I think this is a place where personal experience is important, because this is obviously a very personal thing to be told as an individual that you've got this fatal disease, even though you're perfectly healthy, is going to cause you complete emotional and physical turmoil.
Right. And I think, too, that I think these stories are important to tell because they're not told in the mainstream media.
Yes.
They're not told at all. This is something that's not spoken about. And I bet Bono and Madonna and Elton John, they may have never heard of such things. They may not even know that they were diagnosed with the U.S. and moved to Canada and no longer have an AIDS diagnosis based on the different criteria. For what constitutes an AIDS diagnosis, and they may have never heard from anyone who is perfectly healthy and doing some ordinary or even extraordinary things with their lives, and all of a sudden, due to a couple of numbers on a lab test, they're told they have AIDS.
Well, everybody's going to have to take their red iPod and listen to our podcast, and then they're going to have to go trade it in for a non-red iPod, I guess, when they realize what a scam the red campaign is. But I think we should fade out listening to Charlie's music now, our new theme song.
That sounds great.
Well, it's been great talking to you again, Christine, and look forward to our next podcast in a week or so.
I do too, David, and meanwhile, thanks to everyone for listening.
Yes, send us those comments. We're happy to hear them, and we'll definitely incorporate some of your ideas.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.